Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up on our show tomorrow, by the way, we will ask, what makes an Oscar-winning documentary, the best movie or the best cause? That's coming up tomorrow in advance of the Oscars here on the Brian Lehrer Show. Now, every Thursday this month, we've been talking to Phil Angelides, chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the bipartisan group trying to get to the bottom of how the housing bubble and financial collapse were allowed to happen. Their report is now into its third week on the New York Times bestseller list, though you can also see it for free on FCIC.gov. And for Mr. Angelides' final appearance here today, we thought we would go a little longer than his other visits, as he has graciously agreed to a round of Ask the Chairman, everything you always wanted to know about the financial crisis but had no one to ask. So if you have any questions about the financial crisis or the related housing bubble, you can call in right now and Mr. Angelides will give you his take on it. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. You can ask about how we got there, where we are now, the policies that are being enacted to dig us out and prevent a repeat, anything really about the biggest economic shock in the lifetimes of really all of us who are under 80 years old. For Phil Angelides, chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the former California State Treasurer and 2006 Democratic gubernatorial candidate there as well, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Mr. Angelides, welcome back to WNYC for the last in this series, and thanks again for giving us so much time.
Oh, pleasure to be with you, Brian.
So while people's calls are coming in, let me take a few minutes and ask you to respond to some of the dissenting opinions of the Republicans on your commission, because as many of our listeners know, this commission did not produce a unified report, but rather a majority report signed only by the Democratic appointees, including yourself, and two dissents from Republicans on the commission, which are all included in the book, by the way. Phil, is that why it's a bestseller? You have the narrative plot tension of our American polarized politics?
Well, I actually think it's a best-selling report because there's just a tremendous hunger to know what happened. And most of this report, yes, we've made some very firm conclusions, but you know, the bulk of this report, some 400 pages, is a captivating, sadly so, narrative of the events and forces that led to the country to the condition we're in today.
So the most interesting thing to me, and I think the central conclusion of the Republican dissent, the main Republican dissent.
And let me point out that of the six members who signed the commission's conclusions, five were Democrats. There was one independent on the commission. That person joined the Democrats. And then there were two Republican dissents. There wasn't agreement among the minority.
Right. There were three Republicans in a main Republican dissent, and there was one out on his own. So on this idea that we've talked about a lot, you and I, and so much on the show before you came on, that under-regulation of Wall Street's shadow banking system caused the collapse, or from the other side, that Fannie and Freddie guarantees for subprime borrowers caused the collapse, the main Republican dissent says neither of those things explain the similar housing and financial collapses in Europe. So the Republicans here actually reject the too much government theory, and they reject the too little government theory, and they suggest that there was a broader underlying global credit bubble that engulfed housing and other lending in both the United States and abroad. Are they onto something, in your opinion?
Well, so first of all, this is interesting. It's not an issue they raised during the course of the whole year, but it's an issue that on its own accord, the commission staff and the commission looked into. There was, in fact, a lot of money sloshing around in the system. There was foreign capital coming into the U.S. looking for safe real estate assets. There were credit bubbles and housing bubbles in other countries. But two, I think, very important points. Just because you have a lot of capital in the system does not condemn you to the fate of the kind of crisis we've now suffered. 27 million people out of work, 4 million foreclosures, probably going to rise to 13 million. When you know you have that kind of capital available, you have to take the steps. For example, the Federal Reserve putting down prudent mortgage lending standards, regulators constraining excess that will make sure that you don't have an extreme bubble and then an extreme collapse. But it was Alan Greenspan's view that you should never try to prick a bubble. You should just try to clean up afterwards. And in this case, Mr. Greenspan and the others who believe that badly miscalculated. And early on, Joe Stiglitz said something to me and to the commission that really stuck, and that I believe and my fellow commissioners who signed the commission's conclusions came to also. The presence of well-priced capital, lots of available capital, need not be a disaster for a country. That money, instead of being channeled into mortgages that were wholly toxic, into mortgage securities, into repackaged securities, could have been channeled into the production of jobs, enterprises, wealth for the society as a whole. So broadly available capital can be a good thing. And by the way, other countries had the same capital inflows. I think our best example is Canada. Next door, they did have a rise in housing prices, but they had very tight mortgage lending standards. They had a regulated banking system, and they did not experience the kind of crash that we experienced here in the U.S.
All right, you ready for Ask the Chairman?
Yeah, I'm ready.
Phil Angelides, Chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Our lines are jammed, so listeners, you'll have to wait till people finish up in order to get through.
And I'll try to be quick.
Good, that'll be great. And listeners, please be quick with your questions and to the point at 212-433-WNYC. Or you can post your questions online. We'll take some from our comments page at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Brian in Floral Park, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian. Hi, Mr. Angelides. How are you?
Good.
My biggest question, big question for many people in America is, why in the world has no one gone to jail for the pretty much widespread fraud that happened in the, you know, within the housing market, you know, with all the subprime lenders? There was clearly fraud going on there. There was clearly fraud going on in what you call the shadow banking system with all the, you know, CDOs that were being mispriced, and, you know, and also within the ratings agencies. Why is pretty much no one being held accountable for this?
Well,
you know, this is a question I get all the time. And just to start off, we were not set up to be prosecutors. I'm not an attorney, but it was our job to lay out the facts. And also, I might tell you that we had an obligation under law that if we found potential violations of law, we were to refer the information to the Attorney General or the appropriate state attorney generals, and we have done so. Now, what you've asked, I think, is quite striking, because in the wake of the savings and loans crisis, about 1,000 SNL executives were convicted of felonies. In this instance, there's been very little law enforcement. There's activities around the country focused on mortgage fraud at the borrower and mortgage broker level, but very little has been done, if anything, in terms of the systemic fraud that may have existed in the system. And I will say this, in our report, we lay out exactly what happened. We've done our job. The prosecutors need to do theirs. And I do think there's a sense in this country that there hasn't been justice, there hasn't been accountability for what's happened. And even when there have been civil settlements, they've often been very light. For example, I think we read this week that Mr. Mozzillo from Countrywide will not be prosecuted for criminal matters. Now, of course, I'm not, again, a prosecutor, can't comment on any specifics of that case, but in the civil matter, he was charged with dumping $140 million worth of stock at the same time that he was writing memos about how the loans Countrywide were making were toxic or poisonous. I think the fine was $60-some million, of which Countrywide Bank of America paid $20 million. So there was a $140 million gain on the stock and essentially a $40 million penalty. And I think people see that and ask, you know, are we seeing the right kind of law enforcement follow-up in the wake of this crisis?
Are you suggesting that prosecutors are dropping the ball?
Well, I'm just saying what I believe their obligation to do is, you know, we had a year-long investigation. We laid out a lot of facts. There's been other investigations by Carl Levin at the subcommittee on permanent investigations in the Senate. There's been other investigations, and I just think the prosecutorial arm of our government owes it to the American people to pursue cases where there are cases. And I think there's a sense in the country, Brian, that in the wake of this massive breakdown, where there's many instances of matters not being disclosed to investors, where there's many instances of rampant mortgage fraud, I think people expect an aggressive effort, and they haven't seen it.
So who's that on? Is that on Attorney General Holder and U.S. attorneys? Is that on the New York State Attorney General if these companies were on Wall Street? Who's that on?
Well, the New York State Attorney General recently, of course, did bring a case against Ernst & Young. I mean, there are both federal and state level prosecutions to pursue, and you know, these things do take time. My observation, you know, I guess in a sense the jury is still out, is that it needs to be pursued,
right,
and people need to feel there's a sense of real justice.
All right, we lingered on this one for a while because it is.
I think it's very much on people's minds.
Very much. It's the number one question we're getting on our comments page. But let's go on to something else. Frank in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Ask the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Hello.
Hello. As we have so many banks still with so many toxic assets on their books, I was wondering, does anyone have the responsibility for unscrambling CDOs? Don't we need to make sure that we know who holds a promissory note in order to clear the housing market? Otherwise, how can foreclosures proceed?
Yeah, this is one of the greatest dangers that's lingered after the housing crisis. It's a great irony here that the machine that was built that was so efficient at creating millions and millions and millions of mortgages in the 2000s is now proving extraordinarily difficult to unwind because pieces of mortgages are held by different entities. There are banks involved. There are servicers involved. It's making it extraordinarily hard to modify mortgages so people can stay in their homes. It means that foreclosures are moving apace, and it's hurting the housing market very badly, and these toxic assets are staying on the balance sheet of banks. I think this is one area where the administration, with the support of Congress, needs to have a much more aggressive program to modify mortgages so that people can stay in their homes. But it requires effort because there's so many parties involved. You know, during the Depression, Franklin, when life was a lot simpler, it was a relationship between the borrower and the local savings and loan. The federal government had a very aggressive program of thousands of agents who went house to house, savings and loan to savings and loan, to renegotiate mortgages. We need a massive effort in that regard because right now this is continuing as a huge overhang on the housing market, on financial institutions, and therefore the economy.
Bill in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Phil Angelides, chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Hi.
Hi there. Listen, this might sound like a strange question, but during the Bush administration, personal bankruptcy law changed and people could not declare bankruptcy and rid themselves of their debts. I remember at the time getting a slew of offers for credit cards, and I think I got them because I think the banks felt that they had no personal responsibility anymore for giving me credit because I could never discharge that credit in the future. And often I know that many, many people took the increase in their housing as consumer credit. They actually refinanced and then spent things on consumer credit. And I was wondering if there was an investigation as to how that affected the housing market, how many people really lost their houses because the value of the house was driven up, and they went and took that value and put it into consumer goods. And
it's a very
then
interesting.
The housing price went down, and they lost their house.
It's a very interesting question.
Yes, and let me say that it is somewhere in the book, and I'm not sure I can put my thumb on it right now, the page, but we did look at how do you like that? It's just open to the page. Essentially, when people refinance their homes, and of course they took a massive amount out, I think probably the law that really made the difference was back in the 1980s. The Congress made consumer credit loans non-deductible, but obviously the mortgage interest deduction stayed in place, and therefore people borrowed against their homes for credit purposes. And what we found is as people began to withdraw unprecedented amounts of money out of their homes, I might add, in no small part because wages stayed stagnant, about 5% of homeowners pulled out cash to buy a vehicle, and over 40% spent the cash on catch-all categories, including tax payments, closings, gifts, living expenses. So the evidence would indicate about close to half the money being pulled out was being used for consumer purchases versus just pure refinancing or savings for the future.
What about then the repeal of Glass-Steagall? This is another difference between you and the Republicans, I think, where the Republicans say the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which used to separate sort of regular banks from investment firms, and then they weren't separated anymore. Do you think that that led to this bubble and crisis, because suddenly the places that made the home mortgage loans and the places that built those fancy securities around those loans could be the same places?
Well, and in fact, one institution in particular was that place, and it was Citigroup. And if you look at, and by the way, Glass-Steagall was eroded over a period of time. The final repeal came in 1999 when President Clinton was in office and Robert Rubin was secretary, or maybe Larry Summers by that time. But through a series of rulings, the Federal Reserve had weakened those firewalls under Glass-Steagall. But the classic example of a bank that got in trouble through its securities business was Citigroup. I mean, in the end of the day, Citigroup built up about a $55 billion exposure to subprime mortgage securities, and they incurred billions, tens of billions of dollars of losses. And had Glass-Steagall been in place or some separation, that banking institution wouldn't have been threatened. I don't know that it was the cause, but it did add some fuel to the fire.
We'll continue in a minute for our remaining few minutes with everything you always wanted to know about the financial crisis but had no one to ask. You have the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, Phil Angelides, 212-433, WNYC, 433-9692. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Phil Angelides, the chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. He's been good enough to join us every Thursday this month. And for this final appearance, we're doing Ask the Chairman everything you wanted to know about the financial crisis and housing bubble but had no one to ask. And George in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Thanks for having me.
My daughter lives in Brooklyn, by the way, I might add.
Her and 2 million other people. George, go ahead.
So my question stems from, I'm a young professional living in New York, but when I went through college, I was given private loans that I believe that are heavily toxic, even maybe as much as these financial loans that are given for housing and mortgages. There hasn't seemed to be like any regulation with them, and they ended like their. But yeah, aren't we looking for like? Isn't there going to be another crisis with the financial aid load coming up soon?
And they're securitizing more college loans now too.
Yes, in fact, student loans were securitized, and in fact, a large market for securitized student loans shut down and had big problems in 2007. I'm not the best to predict what the future holds, but I will tell you this: if unemployment stays high, if for the foreclosure trend in this country stays steady, it will be a consistent drag. And of course, these all have ripple effects. To the extent that unemployment's high, people are losing homes, they can't make payments on their student loans. All these are continuing threats both to the economy and the financial system. I don't think we're out of the woods by any means at this point in time.
You are the state treasurer of California.
Yep.
In your opinion, would the states be having the day of reckoning that they're having now without the private sector housing and banking crises? Obviously, the states are in worse shape today because of the suddenness and steepness of the crisis. But many people were arguing, even before, that states like New York, New Jersey, and California were on unsustainable health and pension tracks that would have gotten us here anyway. Briefly, what do you think?
Very briefly, let me talk about this, because as treasurer of the state, I was the only statewide elected official who opposed Governor Schwarzenegger's plan in 2003 to borrow, even in the good times, to pay for the state's operating expenses. Here in California, the state was already set up for trouble because it was spending more than it was taking in. But, Brian, let me make one thing clear. Part of that was there was also tax cut fever. In California, we cut taxes by $10 billion a year, and lo and behold, we had, even before the crisis, about a $7 to $8 billion deficit. Here's the truth, though. The majority of the problems the states are facing today is because of this tremendous collapse in the economy. And I find it kind of a rewriting of history for a lot of people on Wall Street and on the right to essentially point to working people, essential state services, and now say, look at what trouble they got themselves in. The fact is, it is the crisis itself that's been the main driver, even in California. California would have had problems on its own accord, made of its own accord, but there's no question that this tremendous economic collapse with 12% unemployment in this state, when you count all the people who want to work full-time and can't find full-time work, have stopped looking for work, it's probably 17%. This was caused by the financial crisis, not by... teachers.
If that's your view on that, again, as California State Treasurer in the past, what do you think about the property tax caps being proposed in states around the country, including New York and New Jersey, in light of how it's turned out in California with Proposition 13, which at least some argue has wrongly deprived the state of gagillions of dollars?
Yeah, I don't know exactly what's being proposed in New York and New Jersey, but I will say this. Proposition 13 did contribute to our problems here. It really robbed local communities of the ability to set what they thought were the right tax levels to pay for services in our state, and there's no question here that it's caused enormous dislocation in California. No question about it.
Rob in Williamsburg, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hey, yeah, I realize the time's at a premium, so there were a couple of things I wanted to ask the senator. First off, I've been to the FCIC website and was trying to check out the resource library, and I got to tell you that the search just doesn't cut it. I'm wondering if you can find a geek somewhere up on Capitol Hill that you can just put up.
We've officially closed down, but I will talk to the technical people today.
And did you have a substance question too, Rob?
Yeah. Well, you, Senator, you've recognized that people are really burning for answers here, but what we're seeing is that answers are being intentionally withheld. So, you know, I've made multiple Freedom of Information Act requests, and most get denied, with the rest coming back with documents largely redacted.
One more chance, Rob. On what?
On basically the failure of Washington Mutual. They released a report, and the key part of the report assessing the FDIC's resolution process, that was withheld.
By the way, he promoted you to senator. You're not
I know,
a senator.
That's okay.
Someday.
By the way, I urge people to go to our website, fcic.gov. You can not only download the report there, but there are thousands of documents, hundreds of thousands of pages, full reports from regulators, emails from corporations. It's a very hundreds of audio interviews. It's a fcic.gov. Let me just say, on Washington Mutual, the Senate Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations has done an excellent piece of work on Washington Mutual. I know that they'll be coming out with a report soon, so I'd urge your listeners to watch for that.
All right. Well, we've only got about a minute left, and again, I want to thank you for coming on four times this month and answering so many questions. As chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, the book is in its third week now on the New York Times bestseller list, though, as you've pointed out several times before, people can read it for free on your website, which is fcic.gov.
And you can order the book there also, and the ebook.
And where do the profits go again?
All the royalties. We have a commercial publisher, Public Affairs, but the royalties that would otherwise go to an author go to the taxpayers of the United States.
And what's next for you?
What's next for me? I'm going to continue to talk about this issue because I think that we built a paper economy that's left us flat on our back, and I want to be an advocate for a responsible capital system that helps create an economy of broad prosperity, not this boom and bust that's so destructive. So I'll do that, spend some time, and become a grandfather in about a week. My second daughter, who lives in Brooklyn next to Prospect Park, will be getting married in the summer. So a little personal citizen time.
Congratulations, and come visit when you're in town.
Love to do that. Thank you very, very much.
Thanks again for doing this series with us, Phil Angelides, Chairman of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. And that's it for today's show. Coming up tomorrow, one of the world's pioneer environmentalists, Lester Brown, founder of the World Watch Institute, now 76, on his lifetime of environmental activism and how far we have come and not. Also tomorrow, what makes an Oscar-winning documentary? The best movie or the best cause? We'll do that in advance of Sunday's Oscars. And, of course, we profiled last week all five Oscar-nominated documentaries, all coming up tomorrow here on The Brian Lehrer Show. I'll talk to you then.